When I was approaching the end of year 10, our careers advisor gathered together my cohort in our school library. I went to a working class, predominantly migrant co-ed high school in the western suburbs of Sydney, and that's not the picture of the meeting, but that is actually my high school library. And this meeting was about what we would do after the end of year 10, and I never forget what he said. He basically said, some of you will go on to year 12, some of you will go to university, and that's excellent, but for most of you, you'll go into TAFE, or you'll end up going straight into manual work after year 10, and that's perfectly fine. Now, a few years later, I had started my first year of university. I was the one of the people who actually got into uni. And one of my closest friends was actually from the northern suburbs, but he was from a working class family. His dad was a graphics designer, and his mum worked as a nurse. And I found out that he had gotten one of the coveted scholarships to Shaw Boys High School, one of the most prestigious schools in the northern suburbs. That's one of their assembly halls where they have like orchestral performances and stuff. And he told me about his first day of year 7. And all the fresh-faced students were ushered into this lavish assembly hall where the principal delivered this rousing speech about how they would be the leaders of tomorrow, the politicians and the captains of industry. Now, whenever I hear someone say the phrase that education is power, I think back on these different experiences that me and my friend had of high school and reflect on how there's not actually just one school system in our society, but there's actually two. On the one side, there's the schools of the rich and powerful. They're born into wealth and power, they're given every advantage and educated in well-funded elite institutions, they make connections with other wealthy families, they are taught that what they do and what they think matters, and they are taught that they're the ones who are fit to rule society. And on the other side, there's the rest of us. We go to run-down, underfunded and under-resourced public schools alongside other poor and working-class people. Our classrooms are overcrowded and our teachers are overworked. We feel less like future leaders and more like prisoners, asking for permission to speak and permission to go to the bathroom. We might be told that we matter, but every single day at school gets us used to the reality that we don't. So, of course, we rightfully come to hate school. Education only brings a sense of empowerment for the few and is part of producing a sense of disempowerment for the many. We're punished if we don't do as we're told and speak out of turn. And of course, if we dare to go one step further and walk out of school to demand action on climate change, we get this.
Kids should go to school. That's what we're here to do. We don't support the idea of kids not going to school to participate in things that can be dealt with outside of school. We do not support our schools being turned into parliaments. What we want is more learning in schools and less activism in schools.
Shame.
Thank you. I'm glad someone else agrees with that. Now it's clear that our schools are badly run. The people in charge, be they education ministers, people like Scott Morrison, or the heads of private education companies, have largely never spent a day in their life teaching students. They clearly don't understand what it's like to learn or teach at a working class school, often because they never went to one. But to leave the explanation at that misses the bigger picture. We have to ask, why is it that people like Scott Morrison are so intent that kids should go to school even though he's actively destroying their future? The nature of our school system is not just an accident or a mistake by people who don't understand. It's not simply just the result of bad policy or corporate greed, although it is all these things as well. It might seem irrational from the standpoint of human need, but it's perfectly logical from the perspective of capitalism. We have to start with the fact that capitalism didn't corrupt the school system, capitalism created it. A class-divided society produces a class-divided school system whose purpose is to reinforce and reproduce that very class-divided society. Now, if school is meant to prepare children for life in the world, I want to start by asking the question, what kind of world are they being prepared to live in? What is it about capitalist society that creates the school system that we see today? Now, when I say that we live in a class-divided society, I don't just mean that there are glaring differences in the wealth and the lives of the rich and the poor. Of course, this is certainly what our society does look like. For Marxists, class is about what your relationship is to how things are produced in society. So, on the one side, you have the capitalist class. These are the people who own and control the means of production, the factories, the mines, the buildings, the machinery, technology, raw materials. These are people like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Guam Adani, Gina Reinhart, Rupert Murdoch. And if you own and control the means of production, you yourself don't have to work to survive, but rather you can hire other people to make products or perform services which you then sell to keep the profits, which you either hoard or you reinvest to make more profit. But that's not life for most of us, and certainly I don't imagine that's life for anyone in this room. For the working class, we don't own mines, factories, offices, or data centers, but in order to survive, we have to purchase life's necessities from the people who do own these things. And how do we get the money to do this? We have to sell the only thing that we have, which is our ability to work. So we have no choice but to go to work for a boss in order to survive. It doesn't matter if we're building skyscrapers, writing code, cooking meals, driving trains, serving coffee, or even teaching students. The basic reality of being a worker is the same. We have to turn up at a given time, do whatever we're told to, dress, speak, and smile as told, and if we don't, we can't feed ourselves or pay our rent. But while this menial cycle of work might make us feel insignificant or unimportant, we're not. The labor of workers is essential for making the entire system function and making its enormous profits. Jeff Bezos is not himself on the floor of Amazon's warehouses picking items. Elon Musk isn't in a factory somewhere assembling electric cars. Gina Reinhart and Guam Adani have never dug up a single lump of coal in their lives. They depend on the labor of thousands of workers to make their wealth, and their profits depend on paying workers only a fraction of what these workers produce. This is what Marxists call exploitation. So the capitalist class needs the working class to make their profits. Which brings us back to the school system and their function for capitalism. The first requirement for the process of exploitation is the existence and the reproduction of the working class itself. Children have to be born, nurtured, and raised. They have to be healthy, survive into adulthood, and be physically able to work and be exploited. They have to be socialized and be able to communicate and interact with other people. They have to be disciplined and respect authority. Now, many of these things are done privately within the family, with women still largely taking on a disproportionate amount of the unpaid work required to raise the next generation of workers. This means that the capitalist class itself doesn't have to take on the lion's share of the cost of reproducing its workforce. But the bosses want more than the family alone can provide. They want workers that have basic standards of language, literacy, and numeracy skills. This general level of education also makes workers in the labor pool more interchangeable, able to be re-employed in different industries and jobs. As economies develop and the general level of technical skills required by the capitalist class changes, the priorities of the school system shifts as well. And today you can see this with industry campaigning for a very strong emphasis on STEM education and coding in schools. An unskilled workforce that doesn't have the appropriate skills for the technical level of society is a squandered opportunity for profit-making in the eyes of industry. But capitalism is not just an economic system, it's also a social and a political system. While the capitalist class might just see workers as inputs into the production process, or as they like to call it, human resources, they have to confront the fact that they are dealing with human beings. Henry Ford summed up the frustration for them when he famously said, "Why is it every time I ask for a pair of hands, they come with a brain attached?" Now, this prospect is actually a dangerous one. What happens if we don't like what we're being asked to do or the conditions that we're subjected to? What if we don't follow instructions? What if we just take the things that we produced? What if we refuse to work and go on strike? What if we overthrew the rich? So one of the fundamental problems for the capitalist class is how to get human beings to accept and participate in a fundamentally inhumane system. And that's where the real utility of the school system lies for capitalism. And it has three key functions to fulfill this end. Firstly, the school system plays an important role in ideologically legitimizing the inequality of capitalism. Secondly, it instills children with the ideological norms and expectations of capitalist society. And finally, and probably most crucially, it socially conditions and prepares children for their place within the class structure of capitalism. So let's begin with dealing with some of the myths around inequality. Now, the idea that the school system legitimizes inequality might be a little bit jarring, because it's quite commonplace for many of us to regard education as a ladder out of poverty or as a weapon against inequality. Now, Horace Mann, one of the founders of the public school system in the United States in the 19th century, is often quoted for describing education as the great equalizer of the conditions of men, the balance wheel of the social machinery. But Mann's chief concern was not actually poverty, but class conflict that threatened the stability of the new industrial society. The famous quote actually concludes with him saying of education, "It does better than to disarm the poor of their hostility towards the rich, it prevents being poor." So for Horace Mann, he did not see the prevention of poverty as the ultimate goal, he merely saw the prevention of poverty as a tool to diffuse hatred of the rich and powerful and to convince workers to accept their lot in life. The ruling and middle-class pioneers of the school system, from the very beginning, saw the school system as part of preserving their position in society rather than undermining it. But even if the school system had somehow been shaped by genuine egalitarian aspirations, it would be incapable of eradicating inequality. Inequality is a fact of capitalism. The concentration and control of wealth by a small minority, a constant drive to lower wages and cut social security to maximise profits, means that the income and living conditions of the working class are disproportionately lower than those of the capitalist class. And one expression of this is that in 2016 to 2017, CEOs in Australia on average made 75 times the annual average salary of their workers. Your class position then affects every aspect of your life, from where you can afford to live, how much and how far you can afford to travel, the quality and the regularity of the meals you can eat, your ability to afford medication, your ability to survive periods without work, the things that you can buy, the amount of free time that you have, and of course, the schools that you can attend. Now, the school system doesn't exist in a bubble that's separated off from the rest of society. In fact, the inequality that exists in society is reflected within schools itself. And less than 2 weeks ago, the ABC published a comprehensive study of the inequality in the Australian school system. A significant reflection of this was the amount that schools spent on new facilities and renovations. And as Omar mentioned in the opening night panel last night, the four wealthiest schools in the country spent more than the poorest 1,800 combined on facilities and infrastructure. Now, what do these richest schools spend this money on? Well, Wesley College was spending $21 million on a new music school, $16 million on new boarding facilities, $2.3 million on a new arts precinct, and was also fundraising $2.5 million for a renovation to its boathouse.
Oh my gosh.
Now, Caulfield Grammar, with an income of over $95 million, was fundraising to build a new aquatic centre with an Olympic-sized pool. Knox Grammar's new $47 million performing arts centre includes a 750-seat auditorium with adjustable orchestra pit and 160-seat intimate performance space. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, Shadow Park Public Primary, the walls haven't been painted in 15 years, and every year the principal walks through the school to decide which two or three classrooms are the worst so that they can recarpet them, because that's all they can afford to fix that year. Parramatta East Public has four times as many demountables as permanent classrooms. Wales Street Public has leaking and collapsed roofs, and it has toilets that don't meet minimum compliance standards. But how much money schools get and what they do with it is actually only part of this picture of inequality. Your social class impacts heavily on how well you do at school. The poorer you are, the harder it is to do better, and the wealthier you are, the more advantages you have. And this is hardly surprising. Students from poorer families can't afford the exorbitant fees of private schools or to live in suburbs with higher rent and better performing schools. They're much more likely to attend under-resourced public schools where the conditions of schooling actually make learning harder. Like, for example, my high school in the western suburbs, where it reaches over 40 degrees, had inadequate fans and air conditioning that didn't work in its classrooms, so hot weather meant we could barely focus even if we tried. Now, our computers were old and often didn't work, and bigger class sizes mean that you have less individual support from your teachers, whose workload and working conditions have an impact on their ability to help their students. But it's not just about the school. Like, cheaper and lower quality food and skipping meals have an impact on your concentration and mood. Parents who have to work longer hours may not be able to help with schoolwork, and a lower income means that you are less able to afford tutoring or other learning aids. Teenagers who have to work to help out their families will have less time to dedicate to study outside of school and may be fatigued when they finally reach school because they're up late at night working or working additional hours on top. So there's a myriad of ways in which economic disadvantage can translate into lower academic achievement. And just as one illustration of this, let's take a geographical survey of inequality across Sydney. So the blue areas are the more wealthier areas, the red areas are the poorer ones. This shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone who lives in Sydney. And then if you overlay that with a Fairfax study examining HSC results in government schools, you'll see that there's actually quite a strong correlation between where people live, the higher levels of disadvantage, and the low academic performance. So the red dots are actually lower overall HSC scores. So even if somehow doing well at school was the way to drag yourself out of poverty, if you're born poor, it's basically a recipe for the large part, staying poor. But it's one thing to say that schools can't fix inequality. It's another thing to claim, like I've done, that the school system is part of ideologically justifying it. So how do I explain this? Under feudalism, the ruling class justified their rule through religion and the idea of divine right. So some people were just selected by God to rule over everyone. But capitalism relies on a different kind of ideology. We supposedly live in a society where we are all created equal, and our society offers us an equal opportunity to succeed. Schools play an important role in upholding this ideology and the myth of meritocracy. as an institution that offers a supposedly level playing field for society to be educated, tested, and then sorted into high and low achievers who are rewarded accordingly. Our passage into higher education, our ultimate roles in life, and our prosperity are then a product of a supposedly neutral and objective process of assessment that reflects our natural abilities. So if there's a class of people in society who are rich, the school system legitimizes the idea that it's because they're smarter, more capable, or perhaps just more hardworking than everyone else. The implication of this is that the people who are poor are in this situation because they're dumber, they're less capable, or they're just plain lazy. Now, this ideology takes the structural inequality of our society and turns it into a question of personal merit. In short, school becomes an institution that legitimizes the rulers and ruled as deserving of their social position. It presents the divisions of classes in society as a reflection of natural differences in ability and thus something that can never be escaped. Now, in addition to the ideological role school play in legitimizing capitalist society, they also teach children about the world. The veneer of schools being institutions of objective education, whose curriculums are developed by experts and reflect a general social consensus, help mask the deeply political and ideological nature of what is actually taught in schools. Now, I think one clear example of this is what we're taught about state institutions. Rather than institutions that keep the rich and powerful in power and the working class held down, they are presented as natural and always acting in the public interest. The government is supposedly a body of highly educated experts who have the best interests of the population at heart, and in the case of parliamentary democracies, supposedly reflect the democratic will of the population. The police are supposedly there to protect us from other ordinary people, any one of who could be dangerous criminals. The legal system is the ultimate arbiter of fairness, who make sure that people are punished appropriately for their crimes. And the army are supposedly a noble bunch who are there to protect our country. Then, of course, there's the nation. We're all taught that we've got a common national identity. Us and Gina Reinhardt and Scott Morrison are all united by our mutual love of freedom, equality, having a laugh, sausage sizzles, Vegemite. I'll never understand Vegemite. Koalas and mateship. Now, that's what makes us different, supposedly, from everyone else who supposedly don't like having freedom or friends. And what better way to show our love for our country that's built on genocide than by standing out in the sun once every week and singing about how great our country is in the general direction of our own national flag? Now, history as well is deeply political, always moved forward by the actions of great individuals and very rarely by the actions of the masses. And also we're taught that all attempts to radically change the world have ended and will always end in violence and dictatorship. Schools also play a significant role in enforcing the prevailing norms around gender and sexuality that we begin to learn very early on in life and that exist in broader society. This manifests itself in sexist double standards about how young women dress and behave, in the expectations around their abilities in different subjects, in the sports students are perceived to have a natural aptitude for, and in the way that sex education is often taught. But these expectations as well are not static. They can be shaped by the changing needs of capitalism, like encouraging more women to take up STEM subjects to have more skilled workers, and can also be shaped by broader social struggles around the questions of women's rights. Students themselves can also be part of challenging these expectations. One of my comrades, Caitlin, who's actually in the room in Socialist Alternative, led a campaign in her all-girls high school for the right to wear pants. So resistance to these expectations is definitely also part of the equation. Now, broader social struggles can also have impacts on the way other ways that students see the world. The historical and continuing segregation of schools in the United States impacts on the way that students see race in broader society. Race and racism are also reinforced when the school system insists that migrants and indigenous children can't receive instruction in their native languages and thus creates a sense of being the other or the outsider in society. The gains of the LGBTI movement has also seen an increased acceptance of LGBTI students in schools. And of course, this, however, is also under contestation. You only need to think about the conservative right establishment in Australia fighting for the right of religious schools to discriminate against LGBTI students and going on a rampage about teaching children that trans people exist. All right. But I think probably the most crucial role that the school system plays is reproducing the social relations of capitalism and preparing school students for their future place in the existing class structure. In her 1980 study, Social Class and the Hidden Curriculum of Work, Jean Anion examined how the education students from particular social classes receive is shaped by the class position that they are expected to occupy. Her observations reflect greater emphasis on decision-making, critical thinking, and control and power the higher that you go up in the class structure. For ruling class students, or as Anyon called them, the executive elite, students were encouraged to develop, in her own words, analytical intellectual powers. Children are continually asked to reason through a problem, to conceptualize rules by which elements may fit together in systems, and then apply these rules in solving a problem. The assumption was that students were being trained to be excellent, powerful leaders who could make well-reasoned and sometimes tough decisions on matters of consequence. And 33 years after Anyon's study, Britain's elite Eton College was engulfed in public controversy when it asked 13-year-old boys to answer the following question as part of a King's Scholarship application. And I quote, "The year is 2040. There have been riots on the streets of London after Britain has run out of petrol because of an oil crisis in the Middle East." I never got asked anything like this. Protesters have attacked public buildings. Several policemen have died. Consequently, the government has deployed the army to curb the protests. After 2 days, the protests have been stopped, but 25 protesters have been killed by the army. You are the Prime Minister. Write the script for a speech to be broadcast to the nation in which you are explaining why employing the army against violent protesters was the only option available to you, and one which was both necessary and moral.
Oh my God.
Now, socialization is as important for reproducing the ruling class as it is for any other class. The ruling class need to be able to make and justify tough decisions that put the interests of social order and the interests of their own class above any other considerations. As a CEO, you have to be willing to cut back on safety or sack thousands of workers and throw them into poverty just to improve your profits. You have to be okay with destroying the Galilee Basin and driving Indigenous people off their land if there's profits to be made there. You have to be okay with waging wars that kill millions of people or separating migrant children from their families and locking them up in concentration camps. Your school has to inculcate you with a sense that you and your decisions are the ones that matter in society and the rules of society do not apply to you. Now, for the students that Anyon described as the affluent professional, or what we would call them the middle class, education encouraged a great deal of critical thinking, creative problem solving, and independent thought. And these usually corresponded with professions ranging from medical and legal professions, engineers, design, advertising, and television. In middle class schools, emphasis was placed on finding the right answer and following directions and doing well to climb the social ladder. This fit with lower managerial positions that required some level of decision-making while still accepting and enforcing the discipline of rules and procedures. It also reflected the more individual and aspirational nature of middle-class life. Now, finally, working-class schools engendered obedience to authority and rote learning. Students were required to follow instructions and respond with the right answers as prompted, with little to no critical engagement. This fits with a class position that involves no decision-making power whatsoever. In their 1976 work, Schooling in Capitalist America, Samuel Bowles and Herbert Gintis went further in examining the ways in which working-class students were socialized with particular behaviors suitable for the workplace. They articulated the concept of the correspondence principle, where different interactions in the classroom environment corresponded with interactions between bosses and workers in the workplace. Students are taught to be disciplined with their time, to turn up on time, to have allotted times for breaks and particular areas of work, and to only leave at the appropriate bell. The authority of the teacher comes to mirror the authority of the boss. Students become passive receptacles of knowledge and ideas with no agency of their own, while all power belongs to the teacher or the principal. Students begin to adjust to restraints on their personal autonomy, raising their hands to ask for permission to speak and even asking for permission to go to the bathroom. Talking back, which is one of my favorite concepts in the world, is the crime of challenging the unquestionable authority of the teacher. Transgressions and a failure to follow these rules results in punishment or penalty in some form. Now, the relationship between students and their work also corresponds to the relationship between workers and the products of their labor. Students produce work according to instructions which they have no say over. They have to produce work under conditions dictated to them using a set number of resources and according to strict timeframes. Students do not work to produce things for their own satisfaction, but rather produce work for others in exchange for external rewards such as grades. And this mirrors how workers do not ultimately own and consume the products of their own labour. They are made for the bosses, and workers instead receive wages. The ultimate purpose becomes to instill within future workers what Bowles and Gintis called an inbuilt supervisor. The idea that students internalize the rules and work ethic commonly sought by employers so as to be able to work in a self-directed fashion with little supervision. They observe that where a minority of workers have managed to elevate themselves into supervisor positions by being a good worker, it's often a reflection of how well they have internalized the desired values and work ethic of their employer, rather than reflecting the quality of their work or the depth of their abilities. This is commonly referred to as being management material. But the socialization of students can also be quite contradictory. Schools encourage a real sense of individualism and competition among students that is intrinsic to capitalism. Students are tested and graded as individuals, they're ranked against each other, and ultimately compete against each other for places in higher education. However, they're also taught to work together, as most workplaces require employees to cooperate to carry out the production process. Students also build social bonds and will help each other out, even when they're not supposed to. It's considered cheating when the cooperation occurs outside of specific parameters, and other students can become a source of instruction and knowledge. Now, despite the mountains of effort to socialise obedient, compliant workers, there's just one glaring problem that the ruling class faces. It doesn't ever completely work. What working class kids get taught in school is very quickly comes up against their day-to-day experience of the world, precisely because the ideology pushed through the school system does not present the world as it actually is. We're told that our society is rational and run by the most educated people in society, but then those in power ignore climate science. We're told that if we work hard, we'll get ahead, but we keep working longer and harder for less while the cost of living goes up and we only ever seem to go backwards. We're also told to behave and act in certain ways, but then doing so goes against our interests and how we want to live our lives. So as a result of that, we don't stick to the norms of gender and sexuality that we're supposed to. We walk out of school or occupy intersections because we need a habitable planet to live on. We take extra time on our lunch breaks. We skip school or chuck a sickie at work because school is shit. And work is shit, and some days we just need to feel like we don't belong to anyone but ourselves. Now, workers still realise that if we're going to get a pay rise or stand up to mistreatment at work, we need to band together, join our unions, and go on strike. I think most importantly, when our teachers go on strike, against what to them is the conditions of employment and to us is our conditions of education, we learn perhaps the most important lesson of all, that working class people don't have to just put up with the scraps that we're given. Now, no matter how hard the school system, the media, the government and the bosses try, they can't stop us from resisting. And even at school, we don't exist in a bubble that's separated off from the world that we're told that we'll one day inherit. So naturally, we take an interest in the world around us, and clearly, we don't like what we see. School students have always been a part of significant social struggles, if not been at the forefront of them, such as we see today with the climate strikes. In the 1970s, thousands of school students joined the protests against the war in Vietnam and in 2003 against the war in Iraq. In 1976, thousands of black South African students led the Soweto uprisings against the apartheid regime. Being part of mass struggle gives students a sense of their own collective power, something that we're taught to feel that we don't have. Struggle also turns burning anger into a greater political consciousness as students come to grip with not only how they're going to resist and organise, but also with broader political questions in society. In the 1970s, the Anti-Nazi League exploded across England in opposition to the National Front. The massive Rock Against Racism concert and the broader social movements inspired high school students to take the struggle against the Nazis into their own schools.
Front,
pretty cool. The working class gets its education in the process of struggle, and that's where we see the real divides, what the real divides are in society, and start to learn how society really works. But revolutions kick this process into overdrive. Revolutions, moments when the masses take history into their own hands, have always seen a flowering of education and a great thirst for knowledge and debate. These are moments where people feel like, for once, that the world can be theirs, and so what they think and what they do in the world actually starts to matter. Politics can no longer be the luxury of those you're trying to overthrow. It is a necessity if your revolution is going to win. And I can think of no better example of this than Ali, a 12-year-old school student interviewed in Cairo a year after the Egyptian revolution in 2011 that overthrew the US-backed dictator of 30 years, Hosni Mubarak. Now, Ali was being interviewed about why he was now protesting against the right-wing neoliberal Muslim Brotherhood government that had replaced the military regime. So, and not only do revolutions transform those who carry them out, as you can see with Ali, they open up the possibility for society and all of its institutions being transformed, including the school system itself. And one example of this stands above all others, and that is the Russian Revolution of 1917. Now, the revolution, what often gets written out of the history textbooks is that it was not just a different party taking power through parliament, but a different class taking power over society. Workers took over their workplaces, kicked out their bosses, democratically ran them in their own interests, and set up their own institutions of power, the Soviets, to exercise decision-making over society. The working class was actually in power, and the education system was transformed to reflect this. Working class kids were no longer being prepared for a life of subordination to their employers, but a life where they would have genuine control over society and over their own lives. Expenditure on education was increased tenfold, free universal access to education was introduced, and co-education was implemented to combat sex discrimination. Schools were now democratically run by teachers and students. Students formed their own student governments and elected their own representatives to make decisions about curriculum alongside teachers. New forms of experimental pedagogy were developed. Learning was focused around giving students skills to solve real-world problems, developing their sense of agency and confidence, and freedom in the classroom became an essential extension of freedom in the outside world. What could be achieved was ultimately limited by the backwards economic conditions the revolution faced and the Civil War, both of which were insurmountable because the revolution did not spread to the more developed economies like Germany, making possible Stalin's counter-revolution, which reintroduced capitalist social relations. But the revolution gives us a glimpse of the possibilities of a truly liberated education system that are opened up if the working class can overthrow capitalism and take power into its own hands. So, to conclude, the school system exists to reproduce capitalism. It legitimizes and entrenches both the inequality and the dominant ideas of capitalism and conditions students for their future place within the class structure of capitalist society. For the working class in particular, it means being oppressed and subjugated at minimal expense, so that we can become obedient workers and our labour can be exploited by the rich to line their own pockets. We rightfully come to hate these institutions that go through such lengths to make us think that there's something wrong with us when we speak up, when we think for ourselves, express our creativity, and try and have a say over our society. Today, people can see all sorts of problems of the school system, and they can envision what a better school system could look like, and that's quite an easy thing to do if you consider all the problems. And dreaming big is a good thing. Having some imagination and hope that things can be radically different is the first step to actually changing things. But the reality of the school system means that even basic improvements to that system will require struggle by teachers, students, and working class communities. for the school system to be fundamentally transformed, it means the working class has to take control over society as a whole. Only then can we have a truly liberated education system in a society where the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. Now, some might call that utopian, an impossible dream, in defiance of fundamental human nature. But if there's one thing that I absolutely love about the school system under capitalism, it's that its very existence disproves the idea that capitalism is a reflection of human nature. Because if capitalism came naturally, if it were natural for us to be competitive, individualistic, and subservient, then the capitalist class would have no need for the school system. They try so hard to make sure that the only thing we ever question is our own power. They go through such lengths to try and drill all that into us and convince us that the world as we see it today is the best that we can hope for. The fact that they have to do that at all is what gives me hope that another world is actually possible.